Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. Really great to be back. And that was, from Yellow, a phrase that I feel like saying quite a lot nowadays, like, oh yeah? Oh, I don't know. Before that, Wild Hearts, Vanilla Radio, suggesting that you turn your radio down, which in my experience with People's Internet Radio is never a good idea. Turn it up, that's what I say. Before that, a good old tune from the Pink Fairies, Between the Lines, Reading Between the Lines, which seems like a fair enough approach until you realise that there actually are no lines to read between. Well, in, 10-15 minutes or so, I hope to be joined live on the show by Pete Kroll, who's the man who was last on the show, I think, best part of 2.5 years ago, and he was talking about his approach in dealing with council tax, and I think it was a parking ticket, or it might have been the apparent failure to wear a safety belt, I can't remember. But he's been beavering away for all that time, kind of in the bowels of the beast, really. I think acting as some kind of antibody, asking questions, and trying to find out just exactly what it is that is thought to be going on. And he's been working pretty closely with Guy Taylor, really trying to discover whether any of the documents that appear currently to be being served to harass people and generally inconvenience them. There has been a general exploration as to whether any of these are kind of in any way legitimate. And it strikes me that they're in that practically none of it is. That it's a kind of a skein of something which is not at all what it looks like. And Pete's particular mission has been to try and get the Ministry of Justice to tell him whether councils are required to comply with the regulations that are supposedly governing them. Hopefully we'll be joined by Guy Taylor as well for the early part of the show. I'm hoping to talk to him about the conversation that he had with the MI5 terrorist helpline, having, it seems to me, with some justification, decided that he and many other people are actually being terrorised, pretty much by the definitions that are on the helpline, by people who, for want of a better word, we might consider to be terrorists, again, by the very definitions that are put forward by MI5. Hopefully he'll be chatting with us about how he got on with that. There we go, that was Thin Lizzy, and the boys are back in town, because I think the boys probably are back in town, or at least they're coming in one by one. I'm joined by Pete Kroll. I think Guy's having a bit of a rest because you've got a busy day tomorrow. Is that right, Pete?
Yeah. We're supposed to be leaving here about 3:30 to get up to Birkenhead to get the ferry over to Ireland. We're wondering if it's sailed because of the storms, but apparently they said it's going to sail.
I think as far as I can gather from what passes for a weather forecast, the storms are going to be passing down past Cornwall and stuff this evening. So hopefully that will calm down for you. What are you doing in foreign parts?
Guy and Roger and Rob from up at Wigan has been asked to give a talk at a big meeting that they're having in Belfast. So we're all travelling over together. I'm not sure whether I'm speaking, but Guy and the other two are.
And what sort of meeting is it?
I don't know. A common law thing of some sort. To be honest, I'm not absolutely sure.
Oh, well, you'll have to let us know how you get on.
Yeah, we'll do.
So what have you been at recently? I know you're kind of digging into the regulations, aren't you?
Yeah, I tend to be a bit of a ferret when it comes to legislation and the fraud that appears to be simply about stealing our money. And so I recently got a notice from the bailiffs, Bristow and Souter, about a parking ticket that I hadn't paid from last August. And on the notice that they sent me, it made reference to the fact that a warrant had been issued on September the 16th. So I phoned up the council and asked them if they could send me a copy of the warrant. Because when I started looking through all the regulations, it actually says in the Traffic Enforcement Centre in Northampton through which every single council parking ticket goes.
Through one place?
Yeah, yeah. So it's one big office. You know, in Northampton, there's the place they called the Bulk Handling Centre.
Yeah, yeah, I know about that one.
And it's a building. I actually went there three times about 10 years ago, trying to find out how the whole parking ticket scam worked.
And they really put in the administration for the whole thing through one place.
Yeah.
So I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, should I, really?
No. As far as I understand, every single unpaid parking ticket that the council wants to enforce goes through that one building. But it's not just parking tickets, it's everything. Funnily enough, I got a claim form from a private parking company the other day from the same building. It's Northampton County Court Business Centre, I think they call it. And they print out these claim forms, which have got the court seal. It's actually a stamp, but the court seal is actually pre-printed on the claim form, so it hasn't been stamped by a judge or anybody.
But also, if it's pre-printed, it's not a seal, is it? Or am I missing something?
We don't think it is, and of course it's one of the new seals, which says the county court rather than the name of a district of a county court.
So those
stamps appear to be becoming obsolete.
So effectively all the courts, well, supposed courts, are acting as just one kind of unified business.
That seems to be what they're doing, yeah. But what's really interesting about the Traffic Enforcement Centre, I think this is something that a lot of people are already aware of, is that it's not a court. They call it the Northampton County Court, or they call it the Northampton County Court Business Centre or something. But as far as I've been able to ascertain, it actually isn't a court. I'm not sure that it really is part of Northampton County Court, because everybody that works in it is an administrator. But this is the thing about when you start trawling through all of the regulations and the legislation, it refers to the people that work in it as officers of the court. But I don't think they are officers of the court. They're just administrators. They're not judges. And I remember the last conversation I had with them about 10 years ago is that I asked the manager. I actually got to speak to the manager of the floor that deals with traffic enforcement. I think it's fourth floor. Different floors deal with different kinds of debt. Because the whole thing is a bulk handling centre for debt.
Oh God!
And I said to her, so what it comes down to is that one of your clerks in your office, possibly yourself, actually rubber stamps the council's request for enforcement, for an authority to enforce the debt. And she said yes. I said, is there any judge involved in making that decision? And she said no. I said, well, do you ever ask a judge anything? And she said, well, we can ask them if it's a difficult case, but normally it doesn't happen. So basically what's happening is that the council issues a request to the Traffic Enforcement Centre in Northampton, saying that they want to have authority to enforce the debt by whatever means. And then the words that they use are, the Traffic Enforcement Centre, after it's done its investigation, which I don't suppose takes more than a second or two, they then seal the request and send it back to the council. And if you read the all of the regulations, what it actually says is it authorises the council to issue a warrant. Now, as far as I understand it, councils can't issue warrants. It's only courts that issue warrants. But as Mr. Ebert is always saying, the culture has become so that all of these standard procedures become the norm. So they think that they can send some sort of a warrant document electronically to the bailiffs. The bailiffs print it out, and then they have that as a warrant.
Aren't there fairly strict strict regulations on exactly what a warrant is?
Well, that's what I've always thought, and everybody that I know thinks that that's the case as well. Now, if you go onto the Westlaw website, which is there's one particular page on there, which is all civil forms, civil procedure forms, And there are various forms on there that are really interesting, and encourage everybody to have a look at it and see what
was the name. What was the name of that site again?
Westlaw.
Westlaw.
Yeah, if you just Google, the easiest thing is to Google Westlaw forms. I think Westlaw is one of these agencies that's got a contract to issue government forms or whatever, legal forms. But it's all in the civil, really. Except that there are some magistrates' forms in there as well. But basically, a massive great list of forms. Now, the worrying thing is, of course, just to digress a little bit, in the world of fraudulent documents, it's dead easy for any of us to download the templates off there. And if we can forge some court stamps or seals or get given them or whatever, we can actually issue our own documents that look as though they've come from the court. And with evictions, we've seen a few forgeries over the past year or two. So this is what we think is happening, is that a lot of writs of possession are actually getting forged. But to go back to the simple issue of parking tickets, in which they're not forged, they are issued. I've had some interesting telephone calls with the county council that issued this ticket, and they said what happens is that when the Traffic Enforcement Centre has authorised it, they electronically send a warrant to the bailiffs, which the bailiffs print out. So I said to the council, well, if you send it to them electronically, why can't you send it to me electronically so that I can see what it is that you've issued? And they seem to think that would be difficult or awkward or something. So that they haven't yet sent me one, but what they did do was they phoned up the bailiffs and asked the bailiffs to send me one, which I've actually got. And of course, it isn't a proper warrant because it's got no coat of arms on it, it's got no seal, no nothing. It just says warrant of execution across the top, and then it's got various details about the case, but it absolutely isn't a proper warrant.
Would we expect a warrant to be signed by a living soul of some sort?
I would have thought that either the judge or the magistrate would have to sign it. But the thing is that when you start looking into what proper warrants are, they're actually quite a serious matter, because on the Westlaw website, if you have a look at form N323, that one is a request for a warrant of execution. So you basically, if you want a warrant to enforce a debt, you have to make a request to the court to issue one. Now, what's the inconvenient fact is that if you look at that form, at the top right-hand corner, it asks for the claim number, which is the original county court claim that made you a debtor. Now, that would be a court order issued in favour of the creditor who made the application. But it would have to be a proper county court hearing decided by a judge. That's the way it's supposed to work, as far as I understand. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to making a request on the proper form for the issuance of a warrant, you have to put some evidence that there's a claim, a previous claim, that an order has been issued on, so that the court that's being asked to issue the warrant knows that it's a genuine judgment of the debt. That's what I understand is supposed to happen before a warrant can be issued.
So they're not scoring very high on their own procedural adherence at all, are they?
No, they're not. But then it starts to get much more convoluted, because when you go right back to the enforcement of traffic offences or parking tickets regulations 1993, it actually says there that the council may issue an order, may issue a warrant of fere facias. Well, fere facias, they call it FIFA or FIFA or whatever they call it. I think it's the old Latin name for a warrant of execution, which is now called a warrant of control. That is control of your goods. But a warrant of FIFA, fere facias, is actually, it's a court-issued document. I don't see how council can possibly have the authority to issue one of those. Because that has got to be issued by a judge or a magistrate, as far as I know. And it would have to be backed up by a court order making you a debtor.
It's almost as if they think that by writing county court or county court business centre on top of a piece of paper, that actually gives them all the powers of a court.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what they think. And that's what they actually tell us. And they actually say that. But then where the contradictions start to come in is... If the enforcement regulations of 1993 are still in force, and according to the civil procedure rules they are, as far as I've been able to ascertain, then that means that the councils are bound, and the word is may, the council may issue a writ of fere facias. That's what it actually says. But then when you start reading in the traffic enforcement website stuff, it talks about officers of the court, which they're not officers of the court because it isn't a court, and they also talk about giving the council the authority to issue a warrant, and it actually says that the council should issue a warrant. So on in one part of the regulations it's saying or at least inferring very strongly that due process should be adhered to. And in another part of the regulations, they're actually saying that the council can do it instead of the court. Not in those full words.
That's got to be the key, isn't it? Is that there's sort of contradictory rules.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's the point in having a status quo of any sort or a benchmark if you then ignore the benchmark?
Well, what I think's happening is that they've written these things as a fudge, and that fudge, I think that fudge begins its life in various bits of legislation. It's actually fairly common if you read through a lot of legislative writings and acts of parliament. You see these words as if, I first came across it in the Extradition Act. Because when that first started to get a lot of publicity, it was a bit before the Gary McKinnon case, where the Extradition Act of 2003 changed the law, making it not mandatory that the country that was requesting extradition had to present a prima facie case, had to present evidence of a prima facie case against the person before our government could actually grant an extradition order against anybody.
And we have seen a lot of people exported to Europe, haven't we, on pretty shaky ground.
Yeah. In fact, the European arrest warrant, I think, was initiated in the same act.
Right.
The Extradition Act of 2003. If you go on Wikipedia, you can see a world map with different coloured blocks. And I believe that a Schedule 2 or a Group 2 country includes the United States. So when you read through the legislation, when I first got interested in it, not that I'm a fan of bankers by any means, but when the NatWest 3 were extradited to America about 4 or 5 years ago now, I think it was.
What were they sent over for? Can you remind me?
Some sort of banking fraud.
Right.
And there was a whole hoo-ha about whether they should be extradited or not. And the Extradition Act, the new one, started to get a lot of attention focused on it. So what happened was, me and somebody else, we tried to get the NatWest 3's solicitors to challenge the act itself, and they weren't interested. So what I did was I phoned up the Ministry of Justice and asked them if they could tell me which part of the act it was that had made the change, because I'd looked through it and I couldn't see anything. And the woman on the phone actually told me it was section 71. Well, if you look in that, it's 70 or 71. If you look in that, you'll find this bit that talks about the requesting state having to give evidence. But then just below it, it says, but, and I can't remember the exact words because I can't find it on my laptop quickly. But it said, but if the requesting state can, or the Secretary of State by order can say that in the above passages which refer to evidence, the Secretary of State can make an order as if information read evidence.
Really?
Yeah, so that's the real slimy way that they write legislation. So what it actually says is, in the first two subsections just above, it speaks about evidence need to be given, but then it completely reverses it by saying, but under certain circumstances or whatever the details are, an order can be made as if information read evidence, and they're in inverted commas. So what that means is that an extradition can take place if information is given as if evidence had been given. So it completely removes the need for a prima facie case to be made by the requesting state. So all they need to do is to give information, and of course that can be anything.
And it does it in very few words, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and it's real sleight of hand because you think, well, you know, what on earth is this? But then if you look at it logically, as if it read evidence actually means it doesn't read evidence, it reads information. But they're saying that it can happen as if it said that. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is that if you look into the Road Traffic Act, I think, is it? It's in the Traffic Enforcement Centre rules, and I think it's also in the Road Traffic Act of 1991, which is where all this stuff starts. It actually says that the Traffic Enforcement Centre can authorise the council to issue a warrant as if a county court had made a judgment. And if you scour through all of the stuff, you'll actually be able to read those words. That means that whenever a traffic warden slaps a demand for money on your windscreen and you don't pay it, and then the council goes through this convoluted, ambiguated set of rules and legislation and regulations and stuff, what it actually means is that a clerk in an office can rubber stamp an authority to a council to send bailiffs around your house to steal your stuff, clamp your car, as if a county court had made a judgment. That's what it actually says, and that's what it's all about. And it's in primary legislation. I think it's in the 1991 Road Traffic Act. It actually uses those words. And you'll see those words all over the place in Acts of Parliament. So really, what they're saying is, we can demand money from you without any court case that finds you innocent or guilty or what. And then we can send bailiffs round your house as if a judge had made a judgment against you as a debtor.
And
it's completely outrageous.
It is. It is.
But it's very, very interesting when you read these words and you piece it all together, and being a logical thinking human being, you think, bloody hell, what is this? Because when you talk to the people in the offices that are administering all this stuff, they think it's perfectly normal, which for them it is.
I guess it has become perfectly normal. I mean, yeah. You know, that I've been led to believe that basically one of the best ways of dealing with bailiffs and the like, and my own personal experience, as you know, suggests this might be a better way than I tried, is to actually ignore them completely because they're generally trying to convince you that they have the right to come through the door, which is a right that they do not have. Do you think that behaviour will change with this sort of legislation? Do you think that these people are turning up believing that because they've got these seriously deficient pieces of paper, that actually gives them the right to knock your door down and come in and take your stuff away? Do you think they do that?
Well, I think they do believe it, yeah. I mean, whether they actually know that it's completely bent or not, I don't know. I mean, I've been on quite a few anti-bailiff actions in the last 6 months, and we've had a lot of conversations with ordinary bailiffs and with the so-called High Court Enforcement Officers, because that's another whole major scam. I'll say a little bit about that later.
Yeah.
But we've got the distinct impression that even though they appear not to care, There can sometimes be a bit of sheepishness in their response to having it pointed out that they're basically doing a job which is throwing people out of their homes. And they are sheepish about it to a certain extent, but they think that they've got the authority.
Do you ever see anything, I mean, a bit sheepish is all right, I guess. I mean, that's progress. But, I mean, do you ever see, because I know that we were told anyway that when the first lot of bailiffs moved in on Bodenham Manor and shunted everybody off the land and stuff, that a couple of them saw fit to kind of to give up that way of earning a living. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I mean, do you ever see?
So go on.
Do you ever see that kind of any humanity really in what's in the people that are doing this?
Well, you do. In the odd individual, you do. I think, funnily enough, you see more of it in police officers or police constables, whatever they are. I think they're all officers, aren't they? Some of them are pretty hacked off with doing the job. I did hear one case where one of the officers on duty in support of some bailiffs actually said that when another one of these jobs came up, he was going to go off sick because he really didn't like doing it.
Mm.
And so yeah, there are the odd ones. I hadn't heard that about the Bodenham ones. I had some conversations with some of them when I was up there because I went up to pick up a load of stuff.
Yeah.
About a month after they took the place, because we had a whole bunch of stuff stored in there. And they were pretty unpleasant altogether. But I had a long conversation with one of the bosses, and he basically really didn't like the way the conversation went.
Mm.
In fact, he said he wasn't going to allow me on site anymore because I got him completely rumbled, because I was quizzing him about his status as a High Court enforcement officer.
Yeah.
In fact, I said to him, I said... because they work for they run a company in Swansea called UK Evict. It's a nice company to set up to earn a living, isn't it?
I've seen the website, and the photograph on the front of it is most disturbing, I think.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, they specialise in chucking squatters out of big buildings in London and places, don't they?
Yeah,
that's their main work. But I had a long conversation with him, and I basically asked him. I said, "Who pays your wages? Is it the High Court or is it UK Evict?" And he says, "Oh, UK Evict." Actually, turns out at the end of the day, he's one of the partners, this particular person. He said, "Oh, UK Evict pays my wages, but we're High Court enforcement officers." And every single question I asked him, he gave me the answer that he didn't want to give, and immediately followed by, "But we are High Court enforcement officers." The simple fact is that they work for private companies, and they're not court officers. They may have had the powers of sheriffs devolved to them by some act or some statutory instrument, but I can't see how they can be court officers. I think the county court bailiffs that come round with a warrant of execution to possess a property, I think they are officers of the court, but the High Court enforcement officers aren't. I think they're just glorified thugs, that lot.
That's certainly the impression you get. I've just pasted their the front page of their website into the chat box for people who want to go and have a look at interesting photo. So,
yeah, and I've done a little bit of research on the way that system works as well, but maybe we come to that a bit later, because essentially it's the same as the Traffic Enforcement Centre.
Yeah, and these guys who you reckon are, you know, county enforcement officers or whatever, and carrying a different style of warrant. Do you reckon
county court bailiffs?
Yes. Do you reckon their paperwork's any more credible?
I think their paperwork might be right. I think, but I'm not at all sure. I've never had a chance to look at any of it, but I had a glimpse of it, one that was held in one of them's hand once, and it looked like the one on the template that I saw on the Westlaw site. So I think it probably is right. But, of course, it does have a pre-printed seal or stamp on it.
Yeah.
Well, distinguished between seals and stamps, because a proper court seal is quite big. And the small stamps have a crown in the middle, inside the circle, whereas, as far as I know, a proper court seal has the date across the middle and the crown is outside the circle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's comforting to think that there might be some documents that are being executed properly, I suppose. But it sounds, I mean, like I say, without a seal, it's not really, again, it's just not a proper, it's not the real thing, is it?
No. No, but well, but I actually wonder whether there is or maybe ever was proper due process when it comes to warrants. I think arrest warrants are usually genuine, I think. But warrants of possession, warrants of execution, I'm not at all sure that the system has ever worked. Mm. I really don't know. Because none of us actually knows for sure what a real proper one looks like. We've seen them on the Westlaw site and we've seen them in bailiff's hands. And they appear to be the right thing. But then there are major questions about how authentic they are ab initio, if you like. Because if you look at the High Court writs of possession that the High Court enforcement officers have, the actual wording of them is suspect. Because what they actually say is that the Queen is commanding them to come and seize property. That's fundamentally the wording on them. But where it says the name of Queen Elizabeth, they haven't got the word Queen there. It just says Elizabeth II, and then various things about dominions and stuff. And then a bit further down, you are hereby commanded to go and seize property or seize goods or whatever it is. But we think that the fact that they've missed the word Queen off actually means that it's not a Crown-issued document. That what they've actually done is the whole system has become so privatised, and that the courts appear to have become privatised along with the police, that they're using wording which resembles a proper Crown authority but actually isn't. It's kind of been turned into a logo.
Yeah, and like High Court enforcement, I saw that as a logo as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think it is. So what we think is that they've actually, by a very sleight of hand, and of course nobody actually knows the difference anyway, because none of us have had the opportunity to sit down and talk to some crusty old person in the judiciary that says, oh yes, boys, this is the way it always used to work when I was an apprentice and when I was a solicitor's clerk and that. And we can say absolutely that this is the proper form for this particular procedure. I don't think anybody actually knows. So who do you turn to for the true knowledge of what a warrant is really supposed to look like? And what judge or magistrate is supposed to issue it?
So it sounds like you've never actually seen one close up to do the forensic thing on it, and you can't find anybody who's old enough to remember ever seeing one.
No, we've seen the modern ones that are possibly genuine, but if they're not, they're passing for genuine. But I haven't got any benchmark. The best I can do is go on the Westlaw site, but we don't know. We don't know whether they really are truly public Crown, whatever. And then of course the questions started to arise: well, which Crown? Is it the Crown of Queen Elizabeth, or is it the Crown of the Vatican in the City of London that they keep on referring to, and us not knowing the difference? So there are major fundamental questions. I guess people listening to this know much more about it than I do. But there are major questions as to where fundamental authority actually lies in any of this stuff.
Well, hopefully it ends up lying with us. I mean,
yeah, of course it should. Of course it should. But then if you boil it right down to its absolute rock bottom common law principles, this whole judicial and police system of judgment and enforcement has fundamentally usurped our right to make a complaint against our neighbour, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because if somebody's stolen something from you, I mean, what would have happened the sort of pre-agriculture days when it was all hunter-gatherers or little villages or tribes or whatever it was? They would have just reared up on each other, wouldn't they? The village elders might have had something to say about it, but basically, it would be up to us to get remedy. But what's happened is that the state and I guess it goes back millennia. This the state has actually said, well, no, you can't take the law into your own hands, and then they do bugger all about it. So I honestly don't know.
Well, in a way, when I realised that the county council were basically effectively hiring or, you know, taking on bailiffs to come and steal stuff from me, that was like being robbed by my neighbours. In fact, it was worse than that, because these are the guys who are, you know, receiving whatever it is, thousands and thousands of pounds of grant from central government in exchange for council tax or however the hell it works, to actually provide a service. And to find that that service included removing a couple of grand's worth of tackle from the garden when the individual, when the you know, title to the stuff is by no means certain, and they've never seen the individual anyway who they're robbing and all that kind of stuff.
That's
that
right,
was really shocking.
Well, it's just theft, isn't it? That's all it is.
Yeah.
And it's going on a grand scale. I mean, the amount of property theft that's going on is just absolutely phenomenal. The evictions for fraudulent bankruptcies. Because, see, the thing is that this I class those fake council tax and parking ticket warrants, I class them as fraudulent documents. And in fact, I think almost all documents that are used for any related purpose are all fraud, because the original claim is fraud. It can't possibly be a valid claim to enforce a parking ticket, because whoever asked for the ticket to be put on in the first place? I've got no agreement with the council that I'm going to pay to park in their street or be restricted the length of time I can stay there. There's no contract at all.
And so plus the fact that the entity that's coming and painting the double yellow lines is then taking the money for parking on them.
That's right. That's right. They're taking the money to park on them. And then if you get uppity and say, no, I'm not going to pay, or just ignore them, then they say, well, so what we'll do is we'll go to our bogus debt enforcement centre in Northampton, and we'll get them to pretend to have the authority to tell us that we can pretend to issue a warrant. So if you boil it right down to its basics, the claimant who's made the demand for money illegally and unlawfully, then illegally and unlawfully, it applies to a cartel of criminals to pretend that they're going to legally or lawfully enforce the debt, which they've arbitrarily imposed in the first place. So it's nice work if you can get it. But
well,
that's actually what they've done, and all they've got on their side is force. Same as across the board.
I suppose that ultimately, like Mahatma Coates put in the chat box, it's a rigged game, which it absolutely is. But I guess in the end, we have to come to the conclusion that our strength must be in peacefulness and numbers.
I really don't know where it's all going to go, but my response to it is to, number one, not pay them any money. That's the first move. But with this particular one, I thought, well, I'm going to start researching this, and I'm going to start asking the council what it is that they think they're doing.
So where did you go next? What was the next question you asked?
Well, I had a couple of very garbled conversations with the woman in Shrewsbury, because I think it was beyond her pay grade, to be honest, because she said that she wasn't the right person to be talking to, because she only dealt with certain bits of the administration and she didn't know any of the rules but she seemed to know something about the system. So I got talking to her. So what I did was I said, have you got your computer there? And she said, yes. So I said, well, I'm going to send you an email. So I sent her an email with three sets of regulations on it as a basis for asking her the basic questions about what it is that they do. And she knew so little about how the whole thing works that when I spoke to her the second time, she told me that I'd actually sent her some of the wrong stuff, and I said to her, "Well, I'm sorry if it's out of date. I'll have to do a bit more research and I'll get back to you." But when I researched it, it turned out that what I'd sent her wasn't out of date at all.
Can you remember what you sent her?
Yes, I sent her part 75 of the civil procedure rules, which appears to be the overarching set of rules that runs as a traffic enforcement centre.
Yeah.
Part 75 of CPR. And in there it actually says, so I sent the part 75, and then the next section of the email was the 1993 regulations that says that the council may issue a writ of fieri facias.
Yeah.
And then the bottom bit was an excerpt from the Shropshire County Council parking page on the website.
What does 75 say, just as a matter of interest? What does it set out for them?
It sets out all the rules and procedures by which they operate their enforcement of unpaid parking tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And 75.1 is a whole list of such and such terms. This term means this, and that term means that. And in 75.1, it actually says the 1993 order means the 1993 enforcement of road traffic debts order 1993. So that immediately proved her wrong, that the 1993 regulations aren't out of date at all. It's just they're still there, and they still fall within the scope of whatever acts and rules have superseded them, but they're still part of it. So now they operate according to the Traffic Management Act of 2004 or something, and she was trying to tell me that act had superseded the 1993 regulations, which it hasn't at all. And it's really convoluted, but if you sift through it all, you start to realise that all of these things are still in force, and all the recent changes that have been made really aren't that much of a change at all. Probably change the amount of fees that the bailiffs are allowed to charge or something like that, or slightly change the system by which they do that. But in essence, it still looks as though the 1993 regulations are in force. And that version of the civil procedure rules, it came out in July, that update. So that 1993 rules must still be in place, and as far as I know, the 1991 Road Traffic Act hasn't been repealed, and that actually has it laid out what, you know, that is the basis for what they do. So part 75 is, as far as I know, it's the only part of the civil procedure rules that relate to parking. So when her response to the fact that I'd sent her something to do with part 75, she said that I hadn't sent her the whole document, and she didn't think I'd sent her enough stuff. That was the response to that bit.
Well, I guess you'd sent her the basic stuff, hadn't you? The kind of the ground upon which you might establish something else.
Well, the only bit I'd sent to her was that the Traffic Enforcement Centre can tell the council that it can issue a warrant, because that's actually wrong. That contradicts the act. It contradicts the regulations of 1993. I didn't get into that particular argument with her. I just wanted to set the basis. But the thing is that she didn't seem capable of understanding that there are different bits of regulations that all have a bearing on what they do. And she said that I hadn't sent her enough of the Part 75. Well, all she needed to do was go online. She could read the whole lot for herself.
It sounds like that was a kind of rebuttal that was handed to her, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it does. But the thing is that I don't think that she's the right person to be talking to. So when I get back to them and I've got a bit more information, I'll talk to her superior about it and see if I can make some headway with them. But what I want to do is I want to be able to say, well, look, you say you're allowed to do this, but this part of the rule says that you're not. You're supposed to be doing something completely different. Of course, we all know that if they had to go to court to get a warrant for every case, they couldn't possibly do it. I mean, apparently the Traffic Enforcement Centre has about 1,000 cases a week just for parking, to say nothing of all the other...
Because I don't. So you got speeding and apparently running a red light and...
Yeah, I don't know whether they deal with that, but they might do, as far as I know. But I've only ever spoken to them about parking.
It's a bit disappointing, isn't it, that there isn't somebody on the end of the line who can answer your questions.
That's right. Well, I did have a bit of a stroke of luck. I sifted through a few websites, and I did find a number in the Ministry of Justice that had something to do with civil procedure rules. So I phoned them up, and I actually had a really good conversation with the lady there. And she's asked me if I email the questions to her, she'll see if she can put it in the hands of some enforcement guy that might have proper answers.
Well, that'd be interesting. How many questions have you got for them?
Well, about three. I can actually tell you what they are. It's all a bit convoluted, but I'll.
You'd be doing well to find somebody in the system who can actually answer your questions, I would imagine.
Well, the thing is, I think there are some people in there that really do want to do it right. This is very interesting. You get certain people that are really defensive and don't want to tell you anything, but there are other people like this woman. She took it really seriously and she really tried. But she said that it was a bit outside her scope. But the fact that I actually got through to somebody and they spoke to me, I thought was really, really, really good.
Yeah, I think that's right, because, again, ultimately one of the solutions to all of this has to be to kind of change the minds and approach of some of the people who are operating,
yeah,
as it were, the system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some really, really, really interesting stuff going on with them. A guy's been asking the Crown Prosecution Service a whole load of extremely awkward questions because they'd be really messing him around. Maybe might talk to him about that a little bit later. But it varies. Sometimes you get to talk to some really good people. Can be very interesting.
It's still one of my fundamental hopes, really, that's what's out there. You know, that there must be a lot of people who are endeavouring to do the job, you know, fulfill the position of trustee because they want to be trusted because of the quality of their experience and information. And my feeling is that there may well be quite a few of those people out there.
Yeah.
But that there's got to come a point where such people can reveal themselves, as it were. It's maybe still a little difficult for them with things just running like a juggernaut, as it were.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they must all be subject to the same strictures as well, you know, in terms of fake liability orders for council tax and people sticking a sticker on their car for parking on a double yellow line or whatever. It applies as much to the people that are working within the system as it does to the people who aren't but are still getting screwed by it.
Yeah, of course it does. Of course, the people in the Civil Procedure Rules Office, they there's no skin off their nose, really. They probably wouldn't mind if I'd figured out something there was an anomaly somewhere. Because I think they just genuinely want to do their job properly.
Yeah.
So I can tell you some of these questions if you're interested.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, the first question is I said I've been informed that since April 2014, the local authorities enforce unpaid parking charges under the Traffic Management Act 2004 Part 6. Is this correct? And then I say I understand that the whole of the process is governed by Civil Procedure Rules Part 75. Is this correct? And that the version of CPR online is up to date and in force, and want to know that. And so then I say, does it therefore follow that the rules are up to date and in force, and that the 2004 Traffic Management Act did not repeal or modify any of the 1993 provisions stated in Part 75.1 of the Civil Procedure Rules? So basically what I'm asking them to confirm is that both sets of regulations are in force, the Civil Procedure Rules and the 1993 regulations.
Yeah, because I guess if not, you'd like to know what is.
Yeah, that's right.
Although all the evidence.
I think that eventually I'll probably speak to some official somewhere in the system that's going to say, can't answer that because it completely contradicts itself, and it also contradicts what they're doing.
And it presumably also in some way implicates whoever it is that answers the question.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, it might do. That's probably what they get worried about.
Yeah.
And then I've also got, apart from an actual quote from 75.1, civil procedure rule, local authority warrant of control means a warrant of control issued by a local authority under Article 5 of the 1993 order. Now, that is in the up-to-date version of the civil procedure rules.
And it sounds like the local authorities have not a lot to do with it, really, if it's all going through one floor of a building somewhere.
That's right. That's right. They sort of wash their hands of it. In fact, what they said to me is, you'll have to speak to the Traffic Enforcement Centre about that, or you'll have to speak to the bailiffs about that. But what she didn't get is that it's the council that's asking me for the money. They're the principal in this matter. All the others are just agents.
Yeah, they're subcontractors, aren't they? And effectively, they're subcontracted corporations.
That's right.
So
exactly. They're just businesses that the council is paying to do a job for them. But the bailiffs aren't demanding, aren't the originators of the demand for money. The council is. So eventually, I'm going to have to speak to somebody in the council that's going to have to basically take responsibility for that.
Yeah.
So this is very interesting.
I suppose we should bear in mind that they're probably most unused to being asked these questions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it completely throws them. Because fundamentally, what's happened is that the regulations have been written as a complete scam, and they contradict primary legislation, because the primary legislation actually says partially that they're supposed to do things right. Of course, the major problem with the Road Traffic Act of 1991 is that it decriminalised parking anyway. And that's the bit that breaches the Bill of Rights of 1689.
It's also the bit, I guess, that opens it up to all sorts of private contractors to come and turn a buck.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so the whole thing is that due process has been completely usurped by business. That's fundamentally what's happened.
And
unfortunately for them, they have to leave certain bits in that look as though they're right. It's almost as though, like Guy's been saying for years now, it's that there is a common law requirement in everything, and the legislators they usually have to leave something in that they don't dare take out, which is actually a common law provision. It's just there.
I guess that's the source of the idea, isn't it? That actually, if you look hard enough, there is some remedy in most of this stuff, at least in theory.
That's right. The only one that I know of where there isn't any remedy is the council tax legislation, because that appears to leave absolutely no remedy for anybody to say, well, look, I don't actually owe you the money.
Mm.
I'm not sure there's anything in there that allows for that. It's just a demand for money, end of. And unless somebody's found it, it'd be great to know if somebody has found it.
There's that bit Simon Spaniard found, isn't there? I can't remember where it was, that basically says that at some point the debts and liabilities of the inhabitants of a county become the debts and liabilities of the county, of the council.
Yeah, apparently so, yeah.
Although yeah. I don't think he's found an instrument to make that work yet.
No, I don't think so. But I've heard other people say this as well. I believe that is the case. I haven't really looked into that. But I think probably one of these days I'm going to have to.
Well, it certainly sounds like that's the kind of place where it's leading, really, but ultimately, they can keep adding bits as much as they like to the legislative instruments and all the rest of it. But if they're having to leave the fundamental drive in there, there's still got to be some hope for resolution, I would have thought.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So what sort of stage are they at in there? I mean, they set the bailiffs on you for a parking fine.
Oh, yeah, well, it just so happens I've never been in when they've come round. So I think they're basically handing it back to the council by this stage.
So the ignoring them is still a pretty a sound approach, because
I'd do that anyway. But if I was in when they came round, I would just tell them tell them that, that they, first of all, they've got to show me the warrant. If they did go so far as to show me the warrant, which I've never heard of any of them doing ever, then I'd just say, well, it's not a proper warrant. Sorry, you're just going to have to go away. And yeah. If they won't show me the warrant, then they're going to have to go away anyway. But the one thing you must never, ever do is to open the door to them, let them in.
Mm. Yeah.
Or just talk to them out of a bedroom window or something.
Yeah.
Or through the letterbox.
Oh, I think
I had a council taxpayer who came around about a year ago. And I spoke to him out of the bedroom window and I said, couldn't you show me the warrant? He said, oh, it doesn't work that way. I said, well, it does around here. You know, either post it to me or put it through the door and then I'll talk to you. And he just walked off.
So despite all of this stuff, they obviously still don't yet feel they have the right to kind of knock down your door and deal with you anyway.
No, I don't think they usually do that, not for these kind of things. The High Court enforcement officers might do, and sometimes it might be that parking and council tax people do get the police and break in, but I'm not sure that's all that common. But I don't know enough about what happens all over the place. But they don't usually break in for this sort of stuff.
Yeah, Sol's put in the chat box one of the favourite PIR phrases, People's Internet Radio phrases, which is document and verify the obligation.
Yeah, well, right. I'm trying to open the chat box up, but I'm having a bit of fun.
Are you?
Yeah, I can't. Haven't managed to find it yet.
And Mahatma Coates put, yeah, it's peoplesinternetradio.com nowadays.
Right.
Should bring it up without too much of a problem.
Oh, right, I've only got one hand, so it's
all bigger. Right. Have you been in the chat box there?
No.
Right, because they'll probably the admin will probably want to scope you, but I'm sure they're listening and will usher you in. Mahatma Coates put, you can sift through the frauds and basically illegalities and present them only for them to be ignored.
Or
you can present them when they're drilling your lock and be ignored. Either way, you're robbed or slung out on the street.
And
they're on a good earner, so they won't stop.
That's right.
It sounds like at this stage the actual drilling of the locks and stuff is, I mean, I don't know. I know that it's fairly common, but I don't think it's common for things like parking tickets yet, is it?
No, I don't think so, no. No, so, I'm not sure they do it for council tax either.
No, so what...
I think most of that is either evictions or the electric companies can get warrants to do that, can't they?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Or do it without bothering to get a warrant or whatever. But they're pretty nasty about stuff. But I think for these things, I think that mostly the worst things that happen is that they clamp your car.
Yeah.
So really, I haven't got any specific remedies for actually how to deal with these buggers when they come round. It's just that I thought it was time to get really familiar with how they actually do the scam on paper.
Yeah.
And it might be that knowing enough about it may actually make a difference. I mean, what I think might happen in my case is that I might be able to embarrass the council so much that they say, okay, well, we won't bother with this one. But if they do that, then that means that I can publicise that and everybody can do it.
Yeah.
Because they're never going to admit they're wrong in public. So, but if we can work out a method whereby we can actually embarrass them into stopping it, then as I think it is possible that might happen, then I'd go for that. But I just have an interest in being forensic about what their writing says.
Yeah. And it's very, very interesting to see what sort of people they've got at the front end of it as well, because again, Simon Spaniard recently posted a how to make a mystery shopper call on his White Rabbit channel, where he phoned up a mortgage advisor, and pretended to be a mystery shopper basically, and asked her a load of questions, and she admitted that she didn't come from a background in banking and that she'd had one month's training to be a mortgage advisor.
Oh, blimey. Yeah. Yeah, well, of course they're a little bit on the run now, aren't they? In certain quarters, because Michael and Benicia had a fantastic win. Him and his father.
Yeah, how did that go? How did do you know much about that?
Well, yeah, I know a little bit about it. He they cornered the judge into giving them a judgment back in July, I think it was. They'd been battling with the courts right up to the High Court for about 5 years. And eventually they cornered the judge into giving them a remedy, which was the exact point that they'd started the action on 5 years before.
Five years.
Yeah, that's right. But it's a major win because basically it proves that the mortgage contract is void. The mortgage deed is void. And the reason is really simple, because in the Law of Property Act, is it the Law of Property Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1989,
yeah,
sections 1 and 2 between them, lay it out that the contract has to be completed on the one occasion. And if it's taken away and changed afterwards, it's void immediately.
And actually, they don't date these deeds anyway on the date they're signed, do they?
That's right. And they usually pencil in "do not date" or something, but then they date it later on when they securitise the loan, I think it is. I'm not quite sure. But of course, one thing is that if it's dated, then that means that they can't put a charge on the house.
Yeah.
Because on that day, it hasn't been paid for.
Well, it might have been 5 years of work, but it sounds like it was worthwhile.
Yeah. And then recently, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, he put out another message. You can read it all on his website. He put out another message saying that the bank had withdrawn their objection to removing the charge. So that means the bank have completely caved in. I think that's Bank of Scotland.
Well, 10 out of 10 to Michael of Benicia, that's what
Absolutely.
I say.
Absolutely. So they're getting the charge taken off the house.
And the thing is that he's also coordinating, isn't he, a group action of some sort with somewhere well over 3 million mortgagees names on it, if I remember rightly. The Bankster Busters.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm not sure he was anticipating on actually getting a result in the English courts on that one, actually. I'd be really good to talk to him and find out.
Yeah.
I'd see if I can get in touch.
Yeah, he's a busy man, but it'd be great if you could talk to him. It'd be really informative. Anyway, what we're going to do is get back to what we were talking about before, which is that I actually took the trouble to go to the Aberystwyth court building a few weeks back, because I wanted to get an answer about High Court writs. Because when, you know, we were talking about High Court enforcement officers.
Yeah.
Well, if you look on their websites, you'll see, you on some of them, you see this thing about transferring up. And I think it's really dodgy. It's a legitimate process, but because apparently what happens is if a creditor or a landlord or whoever it is wants to get possession of a property, and they go to the county court to prove their case, and the judge issues a possession order, that's just an ordinary county court order. Then the creditor has the option of whether to have the county court bailiffs enforce it with a warrant of execution, or if he wants the High Court to enforce it, the High Court enforcement officers. And if he chooses that option, the creditor, then what happens is they have to fill in an application form and pay a £60 fee, and then make an application to the High Court, and then the High Court will issue a High Court writ, a writ of possession. It's different thing from a warrant of execution. And the writs of possession are enforced by the High Court enforcement officers, whereas the warrants of execution are enforced by county court bailiffs. So I started to smell a rat with the transferring up system, because on some of the bailiff websites, you see you'll see the word transferring up mentioned. There may be a tab to press to read about it, and they explain how it works. And they say that they'll do the process for you. So if you're a creditor and you've got a possession order from the county court, you can send that to the High Court enforcement company, and with your fee, and they'll do the High Court bit for you, because people find court appearances troublesome, etc., etc. and then so that you'll pay them to do the High Court application bit, get the writ issued, and then they'll go around and repossess the property. Well, we've seen at least three High Court enforcement actions that are most definitely fraudulent documents. So what we think is happening is that some of them don't even bother to send it to the High Court. They just write it and stamp it themselves. Because the one that Guy got for Bodnam Manor was most definitely a forgery. It had a dodgy seal on it and everything, and it had writing on it that wasn't accurate as well. So we think that the fact that the High Court Enforcement Officer companies are offering this service is gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want, either send it to the court or not, and do it themselves or whatever.
Well, that of course is the whole point of having documents that have seals on them and dates and all that and signatures and all that kind of stuff, is to verify them.
That's right. That's right.
If all they're doing is printing the low-level forms, then I suppose they don't see any reason why they shouldn't just print the next level up.
That's right. So what I decided to do was have a sniff around the process myself. So what I did was I went to the Guy's writ was issued from the, well, according to the seal, was issued by the Hereford Registry of the High Court, because High Courts have regional registries all over the place. And one of them's in Aberystwyth. So I went over there and had a talk to the lady behind the counter. And I asked her about the process of transferring up a county court order into a High Court writ. And eventually, I actually wasn't prepared for this. And it really makes me laugh to think how green I'd been. It eventually turned out that exactly the same thing happens with them as happens with loads of other applications to the county courts or the high courts. And it's essentially the same as the Traffic Enforcement Centre. Those writs are issued by the clerks in the office. They don't go in front of the judge. Because it appears that they take the fact that there's a county court order in place, they take that as evidence that it ought to be enforced by the High Court. And so I said to her, well, at the end of this quite a long conversation, I said, does that mean then that the issuing of these writs is administrative process rather than judicial? And she said, yes.
Blimey, did you get that on the record?
Unfortunately, I didn't have my gadget with me. I didn't realize that it was going to be so significant. Mm. Maybe I'll try it again in another one and get it on tape, because. So basically what they're saying is that they're sending something to the High Court and it gets done by people in offices just the same as if you'd sent it anywhere.
I suppose, again, if none of the courts are actually courts, then I guess in a way it doesn't make any difference, does it?
No, that's right.
Because effectively what they're doing there is they're making a warrant of execution the same thing as a writ of possession.
Yeah, but what it means is, at the end of the day, the bottom line is they can come round with a piece of stuff which is worth no more than a bit of toilet paper and steal anything they want. That's basically what it's down to. And the killer of it, of course, is that when the police are in attendance, as they were at Bodnam and in most other High Court enforcement actions, they say, oh, well, we think the document is genuine. And then when you push them on it, They say, well, we're not legally trained.
But doesn't it make a difference if they've been told? You know, if somebody said to them, look, this is not a real document, and whether you're legally trained or not, if this is the document under whose authority you're supposedly acting, I'm telling you that you don't have the authority to do that. Does this not make a difference?
Well, Guy did that. Guy told the police inspector at Bodnam before they carried him off the premises, which, of course, was assault. He actually got a summons issued against the guy that had carried him off, or the boss. He said to Inspector Crumpton, he said, look, this is a forgery. Look at this, look at that. And Crumpton said, well, I think it's genuine. But then the argument is, and we've said this to the coppers all along, well, if you can't authenticate a document, then you shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be here anyway because it's a civil matter. It's just a dispute between two parties. There's no crime been committed. But they seem to think that they're allowed to do this when they can't even, because almost nobody can anyway, they can't authenticate the paperwork that the bailiffs are claiming gives them the authority to throw you off your property.
And that's not particularly surprising if even the people who are particularly interested in this haven't ever seen a document that can actually be verified.
No. And of course, Guy's had this long-running email exchange with the inspector in West Mercia Police, who is the inspector that's in charge of professional standards, and he's actually said that I can't be expected to be able to determine whether a document is authentic or not.
Well, if you're not, who is?
Well, yeah, but if you're not, then don't send your men in.
Yeah.
Either, because this is the stage it's got to. It's an institutionalised system of theft based on bogus documents which nobody is prepared to put their name to and say that we think this is genuine. Because actually they're not genuine. They are all fraudulent documents, all of them.
So is anyone trying your private prosecution or anything on any of these? Because clearly all of these people are putting themselves outside their limited liability cover by acting outside the terms of their office, surely.
Yeah, they are. And in fact, Guy's got a prosecution started against the bailiff that carried him off the property. And a part of the evidence that the judge eventually, through gritted teeth, accepted was that the writ was a forgery. Or there was a good chance it was a forgery, so there was a case to answer that the bailiff was acting unlawfully because he didn't have the right to be there, according to the document being a forgery. But then the CPS have stepped in and taken the case over and binned it. So then this is what happening over and over. I think Michael Doherty's had all of his cases binned by the CPS. So now there's a major argument going on as to whether the CPS has even really got the authority to have the power to take over a case.
Well, I mean, again, I hopelessly naive. Shall we play the naive devil's advocate here and just say, but I would have assumed that the CPS was there to sort out which of the Crown's many, many cases were most likely to succeed and pursue them, and find the ones that really didn't have any merit and not pursue them. I wouldn't have thought it should, strictly speaking, have anything to do with private complaints, should it?
Well, it depends which way you look at it. But it shouldn't make any difference who brings the complaint. If the case has merit, then it should be heard.
Mm.
And of course, when the judge decides to issue the summons, he's not supposed to be making a judgment about guilt or innocence on the part of the defendant. All he's supposed to do is to assess whether there's a case to answer. But you see, the thing is that this is the second time that the CPS have been one of Guy's cases against somebody who's, loosely speaking, a public official, because the other one was against the British gas bailiffs that broke into his industrial unit and stole a meter.
And that's bang to rights, that one. That's been demonstrated.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the whole history of that is that Guy was found innocent of any wrongdoing in that case. And so then the case against the bailiffs went ahead. CPS binned that one as well. I don't know what we can do. There's a major row going on with the CPS as well, as to whether they actually have the right to be doing this.
Well, I bet there is, because I mean,
so there's an element in this case as well, is that in both cases it's the same CPS people and the same judge. So basically what the CPS are saying to the judge in effect is, that you're a complete tosser for issuing a summons in the first place. So I don't know whether he's told them privately that he's upset with them. I don't know if he even is.
Well, I mean, you know, that raises a question of just exactly what the judge's job is, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I thought he was the one who was supposed to be in a position to make a legal determination, and that, broadly speaking, nobody else is, and I would have thought that includes the CPS.
Yeah, but the judge stated out loud that he doesn't have any power over the CPS, that they have a legal right to be taking over any case that they deem they should. So, I mean, basically, the whole thing's a completely rigged game from top to bottom.
Mm. Yeah.
And anything that any of us tries is just blocked at some point or another. We shouldn't be surprised at all this, but it's great to be able to document the fact that it's happening and be able to understand the minutiae of the way it's happening.
Yeah, and I guess it'll all become important in the long run.
Yeah, but at some point, I honestly don't know how it's all going to pan out. But every single thing is riddled with fraud. It's got contradictory legislation and regulations written on the back of that, and so it goes on and on and on. And they're just absolutely blatant about it.
And the people, the actual living souls involved, are there's just nothing you can do about them at this juncture.
No, well, we just have to keep on trying, don't we? And working away at whatever part of it is presented to us at the time.
Yeah,
trying to break new ground all the time. So, but I mean, it's not all is lost. I mean, Michael and his father had fantastic success, and there is some really important judgments that have happened in different circles in the courts as well. During the past 6 months or so, there was a massive great case of a council tenant against Southwark Borough Council, who'd wrongfully evicted him and destroyed all of his belongings, and the High Court judge was incredibly critical of the council and told them that they'd basically constructed a conspiracy to unlawfully evict this guy. And I think he got a massive great settlement from the council, but they settled out of court, so we don't know how much he got, but he'd put in for a couple of million.
Yeah. And how did he manage to get his case up to the High Court, given that everybody else is just getting rolled over on autopilot?
I don't know. I think he was very persistent. Apparently he'd been here for many years, but he was a Somali refugee or something originally. And I don't know. I think he was just very persistent, and he kept on and on. But the interesting thing is that the judge gave him a wonderful judgment. And then there was another one where Sir James Mumby heard that case about the divorce fraud from Italy. I don't know if you heard about that one.
No, what happened there?
Well, apparently it's difficult to get divorce in Italy, so somebody set up a scam, charging people thousands to apply for a divorce in this country, and they were using a bogus address in Maidenhead. And some sharp-eyed court clerk noticed that a lot of these cases had the same address. And somebody went down there, and apparently it was a business building and it couldn't possibly have been residential. And it turned out that there were nearly 180 divorces passed, all of them claiming that they were living in that one address.
And they actually took a sharp-eyed individual to spot this. They don't actually have their computers set up to go, hang on a moment, there's something a bit odd here.
That's right, yeah.
Because you would have thought a simple exceptions report on that one should have done the job for them, but perhaps I shouldn't be giving them ideas, eh?
Yeah, you would have thought so, but Mumby came up with a judgment which basically voided all of those divorces. And he said it mattered not whether the people were in new marriages or whether they had children in new marriages or anything. But because the divorces were obtained by fraud, and he actually used the word fraud, that they had to be declared void, and he did.
That's going to cause mayhem.
It will. It will. But it's the first time that I can remember that a case like that had actually been decided on the on the issue of fraud. Because it's a thing that doesn't happen often in the courts, as I understand it.
Well, the thing is, exactly the same thing has happened to Guy and several people that Guy knows. It's just that it's not divorce, it's the theft of property. Property has been obtained by fraud, and so it should be given back.
Yeah, of course it should.
I'm interested in these particular judgments because you can't help thinking that there must be some sort of ulterior motive if you dig further into it. Because, well, I mean, that one, the one with the divorces, leaves 180 people potentially as bigamists or all manner of other things.
Oh, God,
I just find my mind playing a little bit on the idea that that a Somali refugee managed to actually win a case somehow against a local council.
That's right.
When the people who are actually making a study of this sort of thing are being wicket kept absolutely to a huge level. And I mean, presumably this Somali guy had legal representation as well. Presumably, unlike people like you and Guy, he wasn't presenting himself. Well, it seems unlikely, doesn't it?
No, I'm not sure. I think he might have, but I can't really remember.
I'd love to have the odd link to that case, because that one, if nothing else, because of the result, it sounds really interesting. I'd like to know a bit more about it.
You can look it up on the, I think it's on the Bailey website, you know, the British and Irish legal whatever. I can't remember how you spell Bailey. It's E-A-I-I-L-I or something. But it's the case is called AA versus Southwark Borough Council.
AA, okay, thank you.
And so it's a 75-page judgment, but the last 10 pages are the important ones.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give that one a look, because that sounds quite interesting. Like I say, because, ever since I got interested in this sort of stuff, people actually managing to beat the council at anything is pretty rare.
Yeah, and of course there's the one that John always keeps referring to, which is the Neary versus Hillingdon Borough Council, which actually has a relationship to the parking ticket question as well, because I think that's the case where the judge actually mentioned Magna Carta, 1297, unfortunately, but he did mention it because it's still relevant to the context that he was speaking in. And in that instance, it was Stephen Neary was a disabled boy, and to give his father some respite care, because he was a full-time carer, they took him into a council home, and then the council wouldn't give him back, and it took over a year to get him back. I think the gist of the judgment was that the council may have rules and regulations saying that they can keep somebody like that, but they're not allowed to do it without due process. So the mistake the council made was that they didn't apply to the court to get a care order for Stephen. They just kept him in there and put his father through hell and high water with loads of court actions, which his father eventually prevailed against the council, because the judge said the council shouldn't have done it. They should have done it through the proper process.
Once again, I guess they were probably, something that might have been going through the back of their minds was, hell, we don't go through the proper process for anything else. Surely we don't need to do it for this.
Well, maybe, yeah. But in all those instances, pretty good judge. So
yeah.
all is not lost. There are good judges there that do make proper judgments. And one of the interesting things I've found about reading those judgments is that the nitpicking detail that the judges have gone into means that they've read the evidence. And they've listened to the evidence, and they've done logical things with the evidence. Your ordinary district judge doesn't bother to read evidence after time. They just rubber stamp for the creditor all the time, or rubber stamp for the council, or the CPS, or whatever. So it's very interesting that there are good judges out there, and they do make good decisions. So of course Michael and his father got a good decision after a major battle. But they did get it, and I don't think that was a good judge. He was cornered, basically. If you read the account of it, he was actually cornered into it.
Michael has got an enormous amount of experience in court, hasn't he?
Yeah, very, very.
And if I remember rightly on that one, basically the reason why it took so long is because each court, which was at least in theory obliged to deal with it, threw their hands up in shock and horror and basically handed it up the line to the next one. And
seems that way, yeah. Mm. But they put restraining order against him. In fact, an extended restraining order means that he virtually could never bring an action in the court.
He had the bloody audacity to win, that's why.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, that was before he won. That was, it'd been going on for some years, I believe. Yeah. So this is all very interesting. So I don't think we should necessarily give up on the idea that we might be able to get justice. But the reason why I think the Stephen Neary case is relevant to the parking ticket question, and may be relevant to loads of other questions as well, is that judgment said that the council has to go through due process. And the detail that I'm interested in is if the 1991 Road Traffic Act says that the council may issue a writ of fieri facias, then the Neary judgment would suggest that doesn't mean the council can go printing its own warrants. What it means is that they may apply to the court for a warrant. It doesn't specifically say that, but I think that's what it actually means.
So do you think there might be some sort of usable precedent there?
Yeah.
Because they like precedent, don't they?
That's right. So if I was to take some sort of action against the council, or even write to their legal department and say, look, in Neary versus Hillingdon, The judge was very specific by saying that the council can't just do what it thinks it's allowed to do. It's got to make applications to the court to do it. Then it may well be that you've broken the law by issuing warrants which haven't been applied for in the proper way to the magistrate's court or wherever it should go.
And under those circumstances, they do become extremely significant decisions, don't they?
Yeah, yes, that's right. It's very, very interesting.
And have these judges got, have they got a sort of track record of making this sort of decision, or is it just some kind of spasm?
No, I don't know. I think it might depend on the individual case, but I'm not sure. I don't know. James Mumby has actually done some quite good things. He's the one that became head of the family division of a year or more ago.
Oh, right. Is he making a difference there? Because that's a place where differences definitely need to be made.
They certainly do. And he has made some critical comments, but I don't know how far he's gone. I really don't know.
I suppose you have to paddle gently in the shallow waters to start with.
Yeah. The first time I heard of him was actually when Brian Gerrish won that case. Do you remember the county council, I think it was Staffordshire, tried to get an injunction against him to take a video off YouTube?
I remember that occurring, but I'd never heard the upshot of it.
A couple of years back. I think it was the video of the social services and the cops coming in and stealing a young baby from a couple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they tried to get an injunction for it to be taken off the internet or something, but Mumby wouldn't let them. And he made some quite strong comments against the Leveson business as well, press freedom and everything.
Yeah, once again, needs commenting against.
Yeah, so I thought he did, you know, it was good judgment in that case. But he's done one or two other good things, but I'm not sure just how much difference he's going to make to all that theft of children in the family courts.
Well, it's certainly a pretty overwhelming challenge at the moment, isn't it?
It's a big one, and look at the forces he's got ranged against him if he was to ever really put his foot down.
Well, like I say, it's my assumption that there's a lot more people like these judges actually in the system that haven't yet been driven to the point where they feel the actual need to say anything, but there must be more of them getting closer and closer to that point.
Yeah, but it really makes you think. I mean, in a system that is so corrupt, and of course it being Britain, it's quite good at pretending for longer than maybe other states do that it's whiter than white. But when the corruption is so deep that I mean, just as a blanket observation, the fact that, they can create debt out of thin air, and then hound you and steal your property to because you haven't paid it. Just across the board, it's so disruptive to the way a society ought to work that it's become endemic. Everybody out there seems to believe that debt is normal and that you get hammered if you're in debt, and it's across the board sort of corrupt notion in the first place, isn't it?
Certainly is, and that's kind of occurred in my lifetime, because credit was really the thing that was concentrated on when I was a youngster. What you needed was to store, or be it, it's still a usurious currency, and so they were still building debt and they were still hypothecating to a certain extent. But by and large, people were encouraged to save money until they had enough money to buy something, whereas... Now I gather that kind of houses are being mortgaged at several times the potential income of the people who are endeavouring to nominally purchase the property.
Yeah.
And that process seems to be gathering ever more pace. But then I suppose A, they need to generate as much cash as possible in order to keep feeding themselves. But also you have to keep generating it. If the thing is generally bankrupt and borrowing loads of money at interest, then by definition, next year, it's going to owe more money and more interest, so it's going to have to borrow more.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole system's completely unsustainable anyway. I mean, how many trillions of debt is there now worldwide?
Yeah.
Multiple trillions of debt. I don't know.
And I guess it used to be the case that if all debts were paid, there'd be no money left. But there must come a point where there's so much debt that just paying the debt off. I still can't help thinking that if everybody, all these national corporations who owe vast quantities of money to other national corporations and stuff, were actually to settle all the debts, then the whole thing would probably look a lot better.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just got crazy, hasn't it? I haven't got an answer.
Well, the problem is, I guess, the fundamental problem is, if you're paying debt with more debt, which is all interest-bearing and stuff, then it's the old snake eating its own tail, isn't it?
Yeah, of course
it's actually totally built into the system.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Pete, I think probably it'd be really good to have a music break, and I know you've got to go really early tomorrow morning, so are you still happy to chat a bit about... Given that Guy's having a nap, can you chat with me a bit about his conversation with MI5?
Well, I think he might be about now. So if you want to bung a record on, and then I'll go and see if he's about.
Oh, that'd be really brilliant. Okay, I'll chuck some tunes on, and we can have a chat in the background in the Skype. It'd be great to see Guy if he's about.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'll see if I can call him.
Brilliant. Well, thanks. That was a very interesting chat, and clearly it'll be worth having you on, if possible, to find out whether you do find somebody worth talking to at the Ministry of Justice, yeah. And if you do, how he answers those pertinent questions.
That's right. Well, I sent the email off this afternoon, so maybe tomorrow or the next day I might get an answer.
Brilliant. Oh, well, yeah, do keep me in touch on the Skype, and I've no doubt that your, as you said, your ferreting mind is probably thinking of several other questions to ask them. I have no
doubt.
Yeah,
plenty, yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. Right, yeah, well... thanks very much, Pete. That was great. And there was appreciative sounds coming out of the chat box.
Oh, people, that's fantastic. Well done, Bob.
So I'll dedicate this next one to you and Guy, actually. It's The Who doing Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere I Choose. And,
right. Great stuff.
There you go, that was I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day from the Pogues, which I think is, I can definitely say that about Guy Taylor, who now joins me on the line. Thanks very much for being there, Guy. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Nick.
Excellent stuff. I think you covered the ongoing saga of Bodnam Manor and the gas people and all the rest of the frauds that you're busy uncovering on Vin's show on Sunday, and a very good chat it was. You mentioned in passing in that conversation the fact that that you'd had some conversations with MI5. Would you like to fill us in a little bit about how you got on with their helpline?
Yeah, certainly. Well, myself and people from all over the UK had a meeting at Mr. Ebert's place, including Peter. We occasionally have a meeting down there about what's going on, you know, and where we're going. And we decided to ring MI5 up because, you know, we're being terrorised, and we've been calling it terrorism for a long time, because ultimately, you know, people aren't dropping bombs on us, not physical bombs in that way, but they're dropping bombs on people by evicting them into the street and using fraudulent instruments, and, you know, the whole thing's we've been invaded by some sort of force, and we're all victims of terrorism of the state in one way or another. So we decided to, after reading the MI5's web page, we decided to give them a ring. So ultimately gave them a call, because everything on there is to do with terrorism and we're being terrorized. And they basically said, nothing to do with us, go and see the police. So that's what we did. And we got into we'd filmed all that, Salon filmed all that, and then we all got into like a minibus, and we all went down to the police station, Collindale, I believe it's called. And so we all got out of the bus and walked in, and I said to the lady at the desk that we'd been sent back down by MI5, which of course we had.
Oh, that was good. How did they respond to that?
Well, it was the headless chickens, really. They didn't really know what to do, but so they all started running about and flapping about. But they gave us a room and an audience straight away, virtually.
And what sort of coppers were you talking to?
Very good coppers. We started off talking to a PC, a young PC, who listened to what we had to say. We said that we're not like the local golf club come down here to have a whinge about something. You know, we're from all over the United Kingdom. We had people from, we had Paula Campbell from Durham, and we had people from London. We had people from Wales, people from the Midlands, Tom Crawford and Ceylon, etc. So we're from all over, and we're here to report terrorism that's going domestic terrorism that's going on a national scale. And the young copper, he was very interested, took down all the points. They then got a detective constable down. He was very interested, and he was an ex CID officer who was involved in something to do with inland revenue frauds or something. So he had some sort of knowledge about warrants, etc., and about the interior process of things. So everything in there was filmed and recorded, and we haven't put that out as yet, because we basically know where it was going. We knew that as good as these coppers were, and as diligent as they were, taking down all the information from each one of us, ultimately further up the food chain, it would get pulled as soon as it got to one of the sort of shiny baton brigade, you know, some chief inspector who's in the Masons or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what we expected, and ultimately that's what we got. But I mean, when the recordings, etc., come out, the two police officers themselves were very diligent, and they'll probably come out as heroes because of their attitude to the whole thing. I mean, they were calling the solicitor, because we were case specific on Mr. Ebert's case, because his was the most most up and coming one that was on his doorstep, and they called the solicitor that was involved suspect one and the bailiff suspect two, because we could clearly show them the documents weren't correct. So they were, as I say, they were very diligent, and they took everything down, spoke to each one of us about what was going on, and we were very pleased with their attitude. But again, we knew further down the line they were going to get removed, and that's basically what happened. You know, they tried to do their job, but got removed from the circumstances. It was amusing because it was foreseeable. But they had said to Mr. Ebert that they would contact the bailiffs and the solicitor and would demand to see the warrant, and they claimed that they had. And, of course, then they said that the other side said, yes, they'd show them the warrant on Friday. Well, of course, his eviction was on the Wednesday.
Yeah.
So that would have been 2 days after the eviction.
It's interesting, so, isn't it, that they believed there was a warrant?
Yes, yeah. They genuinely did believe there was a warrant. They weren't, pulling our legs, like they were. You know, they did believe there was a warrant. And I think this is where the education of the police is coming into hand. But what ultimately happened? We stopped the eviction because they didn't turn up, and too many of us turned up for the eviction. But then they went around a couple of days later and broke their way in and dragged Miss Reber out.
Mm-hmm.
But what was very interesting on that day, because I got there a couple of hours later, but we were all going for another meeting that day. But there was only 10 or 12 of us going to the meeting, was when I was able to, luckily in my briefcase I had there, I was able to go through the paperwork and show that the police that turned up on the occasion when they did remove Mr. Ebert, the way it goes with the paperwork and the fraudulent nature of it, because I've actually got it, just five documents that show us, establish it's fraudulent from beginning to end. And I was talking to the two police officers in the car, and the message came over the radio, which said that it was from the police legal services, the Metropolitan Police Legal Services, and that they were not allowed to question court documents or documents purporting to come from a court. So that made it very, very interesting, because when they said documents purporting to come from a court, because of course, you know, as Peter's probably told you, that you can print these things off the Westlaw website.
Yeah.
And they've already got a court stamp on, and I had one in my case. So I said, what you're telling me is that if I fill out this document, because I'm a judge, I can fill this out now and I can boot the bailiffs out now then. Because you're not allowed to question documents, even if they're only purporting to be court documents.
Good question, Guy. Good question.
Yeah, and they didn't have an answer for it. And one of them said, "Oh, yeah, but we all know you filled it out." I said, "But it doesn't matter, does it? You know, they're only purporting to come from a court." So I think, but I mean, ultimately, the police are—it's just a job to a lot of these lads now, and you know, they know less and less about the law, and you know. And being told that documents are... I mean, when you get some knuckle-dragger, you know, bailiff, being able to wave any bit of paper around, and they're not allowed to question it, then we're in the mess we're in now.
Yes, and, you know, if there's actual instructions coming across the police radio telling them that they can't even question documents purporting to come from a fraud, that, from a court, that makes it pretty deep, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and hopefully some light bulbs will go off. You know, I don't know how many, you know, I mean, John Hurst used to say that there's, you know, about a third of the coppers are all right, about a third of them just doing it for a job, and about a third of them aren't interested at all, and, you know, will go along with whatever. So, I mean, just hope we really sort of wake up a few of the police, really. And that's what we've been trying to be very civil with the police and try and give them an education. And at all stages, we've been offering to train them in court documentation because it's not a difficult thing, you know. I mean, when they're not able to actually dig out any warrant at any stage, they have to start asking questions. And it's all down to these memorandums of understanding that they've got between each other, between the different parties. The police have got a memorandum of understanding with the courts. And the memorandum of understanding is not legally binding, but it's basically that they don't question each other. And that's where we're getting the problems from. So we've got these documents that aren't legally binding, which are overriding everything that's going on between us and, you know, the enemy, as it were, you know, which is the people trying to unlawfully evict us from our homes.
Mm. And... do these memoranda of understanding actually have any legal standing?
No. In fact, if you check out any of these memorandums of understanding, and you can do so, just, well, I suppose if you Google it, but there's various ones of them, the first thing it usually says is, this is not a legally binding document. So it's very much like a common purpose sort of thing, isn't it? Operating beyond authority, yeah?
That's exactly what it sounds like. I mean, that's a very fair description, is it? Operating beyond authority completely.
Yeah, and I mean, then you get you've dumbed down the layers of the police to the point where they're not even allowed to question documents that are purporting to come from a court. And of course, this is what I've been doing with the bailiffs, you know, charging them with various offences due to the fraudulent nature of the documents. So I've charged three different bailiffs now, two of them with burglary, and the last one I charged with assault because they laid hands on me. And, of course, I can establish that the document they used not only was a fraudulent document, clearly fraudulent, the seal was upside down and had the date missing. It purported to come from Sheffield Court, and I've had a letter from Sheffield Court stating that they've never seen hide nor hair of the document or a case, and it was clearly fraudulent. So based on that, the judge had to lay the information for assault against me. But then further down the line, the CPS try nicking these things, and I call them the Clown Prosecution Service. And I had an argument with them last week in court and threatened to arrest the prosecutor, because if they're using fraudulent documents against me, then they're committing a crime. And so they like to think they've got crown immunity, but I've explained to them that they're not James Bond, and they haven't got a license to kill, and they haven't got a license to use fraudulent instruments knowingly to convict people of crimes that don't exist.
And you would have hoped that their crown immunity is suspended from the moment they have obvious facts like that pointed out to them. They're effectively under notice, aren't they?
Well, that's right. Nobody can commit a crime. I mean, nobody's above the law. We're all equal before the law, you know, allegedly. But that's the whole point of charging them, is to establish what's going on. And of course, the CPS are getting themselves in an awful mess with me in particular, because they're bringing prosecutions against me. Anything. If I break wind, they bring a criminal prosecution against me for non-existent crimes, which they've been doing. I mean, I've been on bail, but this time I was on bail this time last year and this time the year before for a criminal offence, and I'm on bail now for criminal offence that haven't been committed. And in fact, isn't even an offence in itself. A British Gas situation was last year and the year before, and this year for trespass in Bodmin. So they keep charging me with non-offences, but yet when I charge the bailiffs with offences, the CPS, the momentum they gain to try and steal the prosecution and dump it is incredible. You wouldn't believe it. So, I mean, I call them the Clown Prosecution Service or the Corporation Protection Service.
Yeah.
Which is basically where we're going. They're using the courts. Very often what's happened, if you've got an abstracting electricity charge, it's not really the CPS's game. It's a private prosecution by British Gas that they get the Crown to contract for. So that's the situation we're in.
Well, it's still got to be a pretty sound approach, because the prosecutions are valid. There's evidence to support them. The Crown Prosecution Service has got to be acting in some sort of sense, in a breach of trust. And, presumably numbers, again, would be a good thing, wouldn't it, to, every single one of these individuals who steps outside of their office and starts causing harm, loss and injury to people should have a private prosecution taken out against them. There's only so many people in the CPS.
Well, that's right. And it's all down to, what I've been saying recently is trying to explain to people, which people know, it's just a matter of simplifying it, is actors and acting, and that's what we're dealing with. So if you're an actor, you've got to act inside the boundaries afforded you by the legislation attached to your acting role. So it basically means don't step out of the box, else nobody can be indemnified to break the law. And this is what we're dealing with. But we're dealing with different forms of people believing actors of certain capacities. So I explained it's almost like if Ken Barlow's killed his wife on Coronation Street and put her in the wardrobe, it would be like a police officer arresting him when he walked down the street thinking he'd seen it on telly, so it must be real.
Yeah.
And this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who are acting outside their authority and there's no one to bring them to book. So I think private prosecutions are the only way to expose this, really and truthfully. And as I say, I've got these private prosecutions gone through. They've then got scooped up by the CPS, but I've still had the summonses issued, and I've still gone down that road. So, I mean, it's a historic fact in, and I've got the paperwork to establish the position I've been in and the position I've been driven to. So, hopefully that'll, stand me in some stead further down the line. I don't know how much further down the line, but we'll keep going,
Well, it's good to know that you're working with numerous people from around the land, as it were, and that each of them has their own specialist experience, don't they?
Well, that's the power we've got, because we're all dealing from completely different angles, and the numbers we've got now are immense, absolutely immense. And again, they're from all over the country. So this goes back to the terrorism angle of it. I mean, you take it when that soldier got cut, stabbed and killed in London, that was terrorism, they said, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but if he'd been thrown in the street by some guys using fraudulent paperwork, and him and his missus and his kids were out in the street, that wouldn't be terrorism then. I mean, we've got to draw a line somewhere, haven't we, yeah?
Yeah.
And some people go and commit suicide due to fraudulent bankruptcies. So that's terrorism. We've had some horrendous cases where these trustees, they're basically flakes, on people's bankruptcies. And when you check them out, some of them aren't even registered. They have not appointed. And so the whole thing, what's happened is when you put anything under a magnifying glass, it starts to fall apart very quickly, and it certainly does when it comes to the legal profession. They're paid to cross the T's and dot the I's and charge us a lot of money for doing their job. Well, we expect them to do their job, and it does look like that when you get any people that are in self-litigants, they never expected us to get the knowledge that we've got by working together and by, communicating our knowledge together over the internet, etc. And they never, it's something they never expected to happen. And it's been the Kraken's coming down.
Yeah. And I guess, I think again, it's one of the things that gives me great cause for hope is that every individual has an individual way of approaching this thing. And it's not only, that puts the administration under pressure, which is probably the best thing you can do to it, is endeavour to tie it up in knots. But it also means lots and lots of individual members of that administration are being educated, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's happening, because everybody takes the information in a different direction and uses it, in some ways that I some people do stuff and I think, wow, what, how have you come out with that? But it's wonderful because they get a different result. And when we pool our results of what's happened, if we blinkered ourselves and focused in one direction, and then they put hurdles in front of it. But it's coming at them from all angles at the moment. And they really, I don't think they can cope. And I don't know. To me, I just don't know how they're going to deal with it, because it must be the amount of traffic that goes on with people not consenting with stuff at the moment must be well beyond,
Well, it's pretty urgent now, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is, yeah. But it's just great that people over here have woke up so much, because, I've said for the last few years about people in Ireland have always been pretty much awake, and there's been this big thing going on in the 10th. And I've just been watching what's been happening in Dublin, over the water, yeah?
Yeah,
And the Irish don't put up with it. And finally people have started to wake in over here and not put up with it over here,
Well, I guess it's the point, isn't it, that people don't, it seems to me anyway, that by and large people don't start taking action until a man comes around taking names. And let's face it, the man is coming round taking names and taking offspring and taking vans and houses and just about anything he can lay his hands on. I mean, I sometimes wonder how many people there are left in the land who aren't either under the cosh themselves or who aren't seeing somebody else under the cosh.
Yeah, and who are these characters? Who are these these characters that are coming round, these bailiffs, you know. I mean, we've had confrontations with these bailiffs now, and, you know, they're just doormen, you know, they're knuckle-draggers, yeah? You know, they're guys who work £30 a night on a door somewhere. And if you allow these guys to go running around with fake bits of paper and tell them that they've got authority to do so, I mean, we had a giggle with the one at Mr. Ebert's the other day, because he kept running around saying he had special powers, you know, and so...
I love that phrase, I've got special powers, where you're not wearing your underpants on the outside, mate, yeah. Prove it.
That's right, yeah. Well, that's why we said, are you a Jedi, sir, like on that video with the policeman and that lad who said to him when he said that he's got special powers, he said, are you a Jedi, sir? Yeah. So that's what we said to him. Because they do, and they believe it. And I mean, what I did with him in particular, I got a copy of a writ 66, which was what they were evicting Mr. Ebert with, which they carried him out the house for. And a writ 66 is basically, you knock the door, and you're supposed to therefore then ask. Now, this is if it was a correct one, right? You knock the door, and you ask for the keys. And if the person tells you to sod off, you're supposed to go away, and then either go and say that there's a contempt of court going on, or get a writ 69 for assistance. That's what's supposed to happen. But, of course, these guys don't get it, so they don't know nothing about even their own documentation. So they shouldn't be using it. But then again, it's not real documentation. So, I mean, it just goes round and round in circles.
That was one of the questions I was asking Pete, was whether people were showing a greater likelihood to just come through your door now, because at least when I started looking into all of this, if you ignored them, they did tend to go away. And also, given how many people, because I saw the Mr. Ebert's original eviction video, and I really liked the kind of peaceful, sort of almost country fair atmosphere of the whole thing. It was more like a garden party.
Yeah. Someone stated on in sort of chat box somewhere that imagine what would happen if the bailiffs had come around and saw the police having tea and sandwiches with us lot, like. But again, the police, they're so naive, you know. They were there having tea and sandwiches, which was wonderful. And as you said, this is, I think, the way to beat it, really, is by mocking it in some ways. And Tom Crawford was a point in history when, like, 300 people turned up. And it just goes to show the strength in numbers that we've got. And since they've set up response all over the country, you know, we're pretty much able to get large groups of people to most spots. You know, there are some hot spots and there are some cold spots around the country, but, you know, pretty much we can get a lot of people anywhere now and to stop the eviction. And the whole point is, you know, it's the boots on the ground thing where we can stop the eviction, but we're not going to stop it if they turn up with the correct paperwork. So whenever I go there, I'm there to look at the documentation. And if the documentation is the prescribed form, then fair enough. You know, I've never seen any documentation to the prescribed form. but
you reckon you'd recognise it if you did?
Well, golly, I might be completely blown at me socks, but it just doesn't happen. And so what happens, I mean, we went to one in Leicester a few weeks ago, and, you know, the moment we were there, the police went over to Tesco's car park, and the Tesco's over the road, and we're scuttling around with the bailiffs. Wondering how they can come and what they're going to do. And, of course, you know, again, the reporters came and said to the reporters, look, we're not here to stop anything. We're here to examine the paperwork. We're here to make sure that the law doesn't get broken. Because if these people come down with fraudulent documentation, then they're going to be arrested. And, of course, we know that the bailiffs, et cetera, the first thing they're worried about the crowd is because of a risk assessment, yeah? And they go back and say, oh, they weren't able to execute their fraudulent paperwork because of the risk. But again, the police shouldn't be cooperating with these characters. Again, it's the memorandums of understanding between the police and the courts that are stopping this. But of course, we know it's the same with the banks. We know it's the same with the utility companies. I mean, I'll just give you an example, Nick, and just to ponder on for people. If you won the lottery, or someone won the lottery, and they won £100,000, say, and they put it in their bank account and went back the following week and saw that the money wasn't there, they'd go to the counter, and what would you do? You'd say to somebody on the counter, what's happened to the £100,000? They said, oh, you took it out last week. Said, oh, I didn't take it out last week. Oh, well, do you want to make a complaint? Well, you'd say, well, no, don't make a complaint. The £100,000 gone missing. So you go to the police, and you say to the police, and they'd say, what would they say? They'd say, it's civil.
Yeah.
That's what they'd say.
Or they might say, from the moment you hand it under that piece of glass, it's the bank's money, you fool.
Yeah. That intelligent, but yeah. But they'd certainly say, it's a civil matter, go and take it out with the bank. And of course, then you go to the bank, and what you'd do is, you'd make a complaint. Well, now immediately, the moment you make a complaint, you're consenting to it to be in the civil. Yeah, realistically.
Yeah.
And then after 6 months, they'd come back and say that there's no merit, you know, that the money was taken out and they had nothing to do with it. So then you go to the financial ombudsman and they pretend to be all interested, but they're just gatekeepers again, and they'll give you another answer saying no merit. Then you go to the banking ombudsman and they do the same. And then you've got three sort of rulings against you, the bank, two ombudsmen. So if you decided then, well, sod this, I'm going to the police again, yeah? Then you go to the police, and the police would say, well, you know, the weight of evidence is against you. You've already taken this through the civil process, and you're acting vexatious because nothing's been done about it that you want. Yeah, it's not worked the way you wanted it to work. And this is what we're dealing with. So, I mean, people, think about that, because if you had that money in the bank account and you had it taken out, and you know, I've had £24,000 taken out of a bank account by an insurance company without permission in the past.
You've had 900, well, 80 grand, another 80 grand taken out of it without your permission, and the whole, you know.
My bill, yeah, that's right. And so it does happen, and then when you find that you're absolutely, there's nowhere you can go, and there's no one you can turn to, and it's starting to look like it's all down to these memorandums of understanding. You know, these memorandums of understanding are what's causing us the problems. Everybody's operating outside the authority that they've got, or you know, passing the buck, and you know, it's not. I know nothing. You know, giving it the Manuel moment.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've been wondering about hearing your story on Vin's show is, you know, you just think, well, I wonder how many other people this is happening to, and it's probably being executed all over the place with complete impunity.
Everywhere, and this is. Well, this is part of the thing as well. We're starting to find people all over the UK that it's happened to. But you see, 20 or 30 years ago, the older generations were told, you know, don't discuss your private matters in public. Yeah.
And yeah.
So, you know, it was all very under, especially if it was, you know, you know, your finances and things, all don't discuss them in public and all this. And of course, now, people are coming forward because they're hearing about myself and other people that things are happening to, and they're coming forward and they're contacting us. We realise that this is going on an industrial scale all over the country. And, of course, we're able to establish that it's happening in all these different points when seemingly it shouldn't. So there's a pattern, and, you know, conspiracies, which when you get charged with conspiracy, you know, as I said before, I've been charged with 8 conspiracies as a younger man, so they do exist. Because I've been charged with 8 of them, although I've never been convicted of one. Because they're the easiest charge to charge you with and the hardest one to prove. But what you look for is you look for a pattern between them. So if there was someone in Liverpool, something criminal happened to them, someone in Leeds and then someone in London, and they say, well, they're 3 isolated events. But if there was one particular chap or one particular group that was operating between those 3 cities that had a connection, that would be the pattern that... That was the oil between the works.
Yeah.
And we're discovering that, you know, the prime movers, as they're called in criminal terminology, we're digging up these prime movers inside all this. So it's happening all over the United Kingdom. More and more people are coming forward, and it's becoming a real monster for them. And some of the documentation that's now floating around is incredible. You know, we've got everybody going to court and with request and notice under 542 of the CPR, just to get their court files, just to have a look, because we're saying to everybody, if you've had a court case in the last few years, just go down, apply that rule to them, and within 48 hours, they've got to give you your case file. And then just show us the documents, which show us the court order that's in there. Make sure the fee's been paid. And make sure there's a supporting affidavit. There's only 3 things you really need in there, yeah?
Yeah.
The application form with a court seal on it. There should be supporting affidavit and a fee paid. And of course, we're discovering that the banks and solicitors' companies aren't paying a fee, which means there's never been any process, which means there was never any proceedings against you in the first place. So the whole thing's null and void.
So that every single one of those as well gives each individual that that's happened to pause for thought, thinking, right, well, how am I going to approach that? What am I going to do about this?
That's right. They can see it's happened to them. Mm. And it's very much, they've been horse trading with your property and your life. You know, when you're walking through the court doors, you believe you're going into a public arena, and really it's someone's hired a little room on the side and they're going, oh, you're in here today. And then they call you in, rip you off, horse trade you, and I mean to the point where we know some of these judges are. You know, we can, in some of these, sometimes we can tell you who the judge is going to be, because they're acting as a capo in that town, perhaps. Yeah,
right.
Acting as the one who keeps everything in house and doesn't let it. And then if you keep kicking off in that particular town, then he'll put a restraining order on you. Mm. This is the way they're operating.
Well, that's quite interesting as well, because there can only be one capo, and there's millions of us.
That's right.
And I think that the system, by definition, can only respond to systematic responses, can't it? So long as people are being individual in the way they approach these things, it is going to be very difficult. For that, I mean, that judge can't sit 36 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week and deal with it all in the long run.
No. I mean, the trouble is we're dealing, and it's straightforward, we're dealing with criminals. They're the ones who just look you in the eye when they're doing it. Mm. And cowards, the ones who won't look you in the eye when they're doing it.
Mm.
And there doesn't seem to be much in between all that.
Or as I say, patsies and frauds. If they know what's going on, they're a fraud. And if they don't know what's going on, they're a patsy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly the situation we've got at the moment, Nick. Mm. So,
and I know we've tried to arrest judges in the past. It was one of my finest days out, that was. Is there any reason why we're not just arresting these people who are serving felonious documents?
That's, I think, where it's all going. I think because people are waking up and saying, well, what the hell can we do? And, I mean, that was the whole idea of, we all know the situation's been a fraud for a long, long time. And it was luckily due to us meeting Mr. Ebert and thinking, well, okay, let's start examining their paperwork. It's changed things a lot because before, when we were saying things weren't constitutionally right or you know, they weren't, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't common law, nobody was really listening to us, yeah? Because they thought the law was the law and that the law was the piece of paper that they were shown, yeah?
Mm.
Now when they're starting to realise that these pieces of paper don't stand up to scrutiny, you know, they don't, you know, they're not the prescribed form of what they should be. And as you said, people are getting it individually, coming to their door. We're getting a mass awakening of people, and it's pretty much, I mean, I say all over the place about the entire system's using fraudulent documents, because I haven't seen any legitimate ones. And I mean, they could arrest me if that was for contempt of court in every case there's been for the last 20 years, because I haven't seen a legitimate document yet. And if they want to arrest me for, I'd have 20 years of contempt if they want to. The fact that they're not a court is, you know, we will be argued on the day, but that's where we are with it. You know, nobody's trying to close me down in that way, because it's the truth.
Yeah.
And now it's out. The thing's out the bag now. So, I mean, you know, everybody there can realise, and they can do it very simply by going down, questioning their own documents, doing it under the CPR 542 and 541, which we've got a little request and notice which we give to people if anyone needs. They can always contact us and get one. Go down, service that within 48 hours, see your file, and you'll see if there's been a big solicitor's firm or a mortgage company, or you'll find that there probably hasn't even been a fee paid. And if there's not been a fee paid, it means there's never been any proceedings against you.
It's amazing, isn't it? It is just amazing. I look forward really to hearing how it all goes. And I mean, I really think that however sometimes futile it seems, actually talking to people like those two coppers and being in the court, and because it's not just the man in a wig and a dress and his you know, the guy that's in charge of him, the clerk of the court. The place is full of ushers and individuals and lots of people who will be paying attention to this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny thing was that we had the Hereford Times, did an article on and said that I was going to arrest the CPS last week, And you wouldn't have got that a couple of years ago, even, really.
No. And again, they said they sound like bang to rights for arrest. I mean, I wonder what happens if you start arresting these people and taking them down to the police station and giving them your folder of bang to rights information.
Well, you know, I'm probably the last person you should say that to, because that's where we're going.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I did say, the clerk did say to me in the court, well, where are you going to take them? And I just sort of smiled and said, well, we'll deal with that when we come to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the humiliation of being arrested and, you know, having to deal with it. But I mean, again, we're going to end up coming to that place very quickly, because I can't see there's any alternative but to do that now, Nick, really. I don't know what else to say, sir. You know, arrests are imminent.
Well, and the other thing is the response idea seems like a real good one to me as well. You know, the fact that as people add their names to the list and stuff, I suppose it's the closest thing to useful activism, really, because you're not getting on the streets, you're just getting into somebody's garden, serving tea to the police and stuff like that. I can see that idea expanding itself, you know.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful idea, and the guys who started it all off, you know, they came up with this idea and response to tyranny, like, and it's fantastic, you know. It's and like you say, because it engages the public as well. The neighbours get involved, and you know, everybody seems to be happy with it, and ultimately, you're not stopping anything. If they come with legitimate paperwork,
carry on,
and but they don't. They won't even show their faces once they get you, once you get there. So we know the enemy now. You know?
I think that's another very pertinent point about it shows what it does is it shows a different face to the neighbours, because I know that when we became involved with bailiffs, that even people who knew us really well turned away. And in this, you know, in England, and to a great extent in Wales, there seems to be a kind of curtain twitching culture, if you like, that will see a uniform outside and assume that you have become a bad lot, no matter what they know about you. Whereas if what you see is a lot of reasonable and experienced people who are willing to talk to you about it, you are more likely to get involved. And that's, I mean, struck me as the big difference between here and, say, Scotland. I've got some good friends in the chat box in Scotland, and it seems to me that if a bailiff turns up on some of those streets in Glasgow, then you need at least as many bailiffs as there are people in those houses, because they're going to come out and make their feelings quite clear.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I mean, again, the Scottish people are very much like the Irish, like that. They're, you know, they're militant, they're on it, you know. It's, well, England's taken a lot more to wake people up, really. I mean, one of my neighbours, actually, I was over, you know, I've got a pub across the road from our house, like, and I don't go over there very often, but I was over there a couple of weeks ago, and she was over there, and I bought her a couple of drinks, and you know, she started saying to me, oh, well, the fear I have is that my children will have to watch an eviction. And I said, what, you know, what about the children that are being evicted wrongly?
Yeah.
You know, what about that?
Put yourself on the other side of the argument for a while.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got to put yourself in the other side's shoes at all times, haven't you? And for people to say things like that, I mean, it just shows, you know, it's ridiculous, wasn't it? It was ridiculous.
I like that. They say that it's always good to walk a mile in another man's shoes, because that way you get to be a mile away from him, and if he decides to chase you, he's got no boots. But, well, that's really great, Guy. I'm ever so grateful for you coming on and sharing all of that with us. And I think, like I say, from where I'm sitting, you're doing a lot of really useful work on the ground. And eventually somebody is going to have to pay attention. And really, it is down to the fact that there's a very small number of people executing all of these crimes, and there are now a very large number of people having them executed upon them.
Yeah, that's right. And we're getting there slowly but surely. There are very good people all over this planet that are informing everybody about what's going on, and I mean everybody, and every member of the European Parliament, every member of Congress, and I mean that about everything that's going on, and they're doing it blind as well, so that if they start just dumping emails en masse, yeah, they're reporting them for dumping emails on mass because they're not opening them up. And things like this are going on as well. So the whole system's being put under a great deal of pressure by a great deal of good people now. So onwards and upwards and a Jaff cake for the general.
Yeah, absolutely great. And I think you get two. If the general gets a Jaffa cake, mate, you get two.
Oh, thank you.
Do you want to say, before we sort of pass on to a bit of music to play the show out, do you want to say a bit about what you're doing in Belfast tomorrow?
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, well, myself, Ben Gilroy, Roger Hayes, Rob Bollocks, and all, and Peter's there, I don't know if Peter's talking, but we've all been invited over to Northern Ireland, and we're being invited over to do presentations there, try and help people save their homes. It's an all-day event, isn't it? Yeah, they've got a buffet on, and the guys who have organised it are absolutely amazing. They've given us, you know, really good quality accommodation, really good travel and everything, and really laid it on really good for all of us. So we're going to try and do as much as we can and give them as big a hand as we can. The address is... Where's it, Pete?
I'm not quite sure.
We're getting picked. Well, we're being so spoiled, we're being picked up. We don't even know where we're going.
That's really great. You get used to that sort of lifestyle. You'll be on the other side before we know where you are.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Russell Brand. Yeah. So, you know, we're being really well treated. And so it's going to be a really good day up in Northern Ireland. And I say Ben's coming up from the south. And, of course, they're all fully conversant with who he is and what the work he does. And, you know, and there are a lot of people in Northern Ireland that communicate with me. And so it's going to be great to go over there. We've been in Wales earlier part of the week and done the stuff in the communal court down in Wales in Port Talbot. So we're really looking forward to it. But we have to set off at about 3:30 this morning. So it's going to be no sleep again, you know. So,
I've got to say it's either stay up all night or not get enough sleep.
Well, that's it. So it's all the same. It's all the same to us.
Well, brilliant. More power to your elbow. And Linda's, I can hear her chuckling in the background. It's really good to hear you both again.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
No problem. Keep up the good work. That's what I say. I'll just put on a tune and have a quick word with you on the Skype. So that was Guy Taylor, folks. Thanks very much to him for coming on. And before him, Peter Kroll. I'll come back to you before the end of the show.